Hare Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahabiryam Karavavahai Tejasvina Vaditamastu Mavidvishavahai Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Okay, bottom of 52. The conclusion is that the retraction of the body, mind, and senses should be thoroughly achieved by any of the genuine methods of retraction. Right, so thoroughly achieved. Even though retraction is a part of the Upaya Bhakti, it may be dangerous for the ignorant men who think that retraction is an independent process with separate results. Such people cause the shutting down of the door of their own process. Because of the superficial differences between the different processes of retraction, there are sectarian controversies which are quite unnecessary. To avoid such controversies, the retraction should be properly followed in association with theistic knowledge and appropriate renunciation. So this, because we notice that of these two, then the attraction to Krishna we don't have much to say about, because it's actually directly devotional, right? Now retraction becomes part of the devotional process because we're connecting it to the Lord, right? So it's something we can relate to because we're dealing with our situation in karma and jnana, right? Then you're taking that and adjusting that. I mean, you're taking that situation and trying to connect it to the Lord. So the karma and jnana is connected, right? Devotion is something else. So the difficulty comes is the devotion may be easily forgotten, while the retraction becomes something very prominent, right? So that does that make sense? Because we relate to it from the platform of jnana, right? Our conditioning, yes. Retraction itself. Retraction.
Yeah, because when you say, like, if we connect karma and jnana, what does the retraction mean?
Retraction means jnana. Means in your path of knowledge, it's based on renunciation, right? Because material activities, then they give distress. Right? Physical activities give physical distress, mental activities mental distress, right? So then the idea is we give up the processes of karma, then we will elevate ourselves, right? So this is how all these impersonal schools will think, right? And even if you're dealing with karma, then the renunciation is just in what is good and bad action for getting prosperous results. Good means it elevates you to heaven, gives you a nice result here, right? Bad means you get a bad result here, you don't get to heaven, right? So the idea of renunciation in either of these is still connected with the idea fruitive endeavor or liberation, right? So our consciousness in the conditioned state relates to that very easily, right? If it's for material benefit or for liberation, we can relate to it. Devotion, that's another thing. Because even our devotion, we're devoted to something, but actually it's just part of karma, right? I mean, in the material world, the person is very devoted to his art, but it's still karma, you know, or he's devoted to helping the uneducated, or, you know, so they'll use these terms because in one sense they're correct in that the natural love of the living entity is being applied to an aspect that they think is important. But the problem is because it's not seen in relationship to God, then it loses its actual real meaning. So the love gets transformed into lust. Right? Real knowledge becomes ignorance. Does that make sense? So here then, the term retraction, you know, means in general the word of renunciation, but retraction means you're pulling back from the unnatural situation in the material sphere back to the neutral position of spirit, the spiritual. Does that make sense? Neutral. Because the spiritual liberation is neutral. Liberation, yeah. Means attraction will have to start before that, but it's after one's come to the liberated point, then that means then the intensity of the attraction is so much greater, right? Because here when we say we're using these terms because they're generic spiritual terms, but for us then the liberation means the platform of Brahma-Bhuta, so we're talking about bhava. Right, so it's within bhava, then it becomes dynamic. Does that make sense? I mean, of course, it's already started to become dynamic in taste and ruchi, but still there are other, you know, considerations. It's still, you're still removing the obstacles, but at liberation there's no obstacles. Right, so then that attraction to Krishna can then go forward without any impediments. Does that make sense? So the difficulty here is what we're saying is that retraction is part of upaya bhakti, but we will have a tendency, because of its familiarity, to take it on its own. So then, because it's part of the devotional process, then we will see it that if I'm simply becoming renounced, I'm actually advancing in Krishna consciousness. No, if you're advancing in Krishna consciousness, you're becoming renounced. But focusing on renunciation does not mean that one will be advancing in devotional service. Right? That's why he says, such people cause the shutting down of the door of their own progress. Because they focus so much on renunciation, so much on those elements of drawing back in their engagement in the material, that they become distracted from the actual primary point of becoming attracted to Krishna. Right? If one's attracted to something in the material energy, it may take a lot of endeavor and attention to bring the attraction out of the material and towards Krishna. Right? But that doesn't mean that at any time one thinks that it is separate and that on its own it gets its own result. But the tendency is we will think it's separate, because for us, jnana has its own results. But the point is only bhakti actually gives the results of karma, of the knowledge and renunciation. Right?
Yes. So it is treated as a fruit of activity.
Yes, so it can be treated as fruit. That's why if somebody does something, it's not renounced, it's very bad. You know, or if you talk about somebody's renounce, oh, that's very bad. You know what I'm saying? You know, it means how you say the sannyasi has to be, you know, 108% renounced, but the grihastha can be -8, you know, and it's okay. You know, because it's just a matter of a zero, right? So, you add a zero, is it? Yes.
So we can read in this paragraph that true religion is one.
True religion is one, yes. Because otherwise then is these points, other points, once we understand the principle, is that it's not a separate part, so it shouldn't be viewed separately. The renunciation is only valuable in as much as it allows for remembrance of the Lord, absorption in the Lord. right? And when it's in the way of it, then it's valuable. But if it's taken on its own, it actually gets in the way of remembering the Lord, because you're so absorbed in being renounced. Right? So it doesn't mean that renunciation is bad. It's a problem. You can't see it separately than the process. So it must be balanced, right? So now, here it's saying that some of the superficial differences between the processes of retraction. Right? We saw in 51, then we had in the middle, then retraction of the senses, renunciation, asceticism, restraint, sense control. Retractions, that was the senses. Then retractions of the body, penance, sacrifice, purity, different kinds of yoga. The mind, forgiveness, sincerity, non-stealing, truthfulness, learning. So sometimes we see them all the same. We can't tell the difference between them. So there'll also be different schools will have different things. And in this way you end up with your so-called different varieties of religions. Because they can't actually tell the difference between the varieties of retraction. You know, what's body, what's mind, what's intelligence. And that it should be connected to the Lord. Because most religious systems can't tell the difference between the body, the mind, and the senses anyway, let alone the processes of retraction. You know what I'm saying? And then you throw the soul into the works, and then it really becomes confusing, right? You know?
And then the three aspects of Godhead.
Yes, you know, yes. You know, so does that mean that, you know, you have the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. Does that mean that one's connected with the body, one with the mind, one with the words, or one with the Son, and he's some for the blood, you know, like this? Yeah, no, it's not.
There was an issue about renunciation in class.
Ah, yes. It's another one of those things to always give
that was
issues.
The point which is not seen as this one.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's taken that it's means, in other words, upaya bhakti, it's got two angas, so therefore the renunciation is very important. But seeing it that it functions on its own, that simply by being renounced, that's devotional, that has no meaning. That you're becoming attracted to Krishna, that can stand on its own, but because we're attached to material energy, you'll always see it along with detachment, right? So, like the example was given before, the person looks very advanced, but then if there's a doubt, you know what I'm saying, if it's obvious, then don't worry about it. But if there's a doubt, then you look at the element of renunciation, right? That detachment. So you have the person that comes, let's say, on the weekend, and they're very enthusiastic. You know, all week they're either at school or they're working, or they're very always there doing everything and all that, went through everything like this and that. And so the element is of the advancement, and you deal like that, and they feel, you know, that they're very advanced. But then you have to look at how much are they pulled back from the material energy. So it's not that they're at school or that they have a job, it's how do they identify with those, what is the results of those for. So if you see that they do good, they make good money, they have a nice house, nice facilities, and that, so they're just as enthusiastic about their home and social life as they are at the temple, then it means that they're enthusiastic but they're not actually very advanced. Because otherwise, that would have been there in the beginning, then they come in contact, then it would be that the house and that starts to go down and be dealt with in a proper way. They have money, they have facilities, they know how to deal with it, but it's not the prominent element. Then you can say, yes, they are advancing, so then you can say it's balanced. Does that make sense? You know, or if you take it more extreme, the sahajis, it looks very advanced and all that, but, you know, they're the all kinds of bad activities that, you know, they consider as just standard, you know. So then it doesn't balance, it doesn't match. So the point is that it shouldn't be seen as separate, but it shouldn't be neglected, because we generally tend to do one or the other, right? It's a separate system because of karma and jnana, or if it's not useful, then according to, if it's not, you know, the main thing of devotion, why I should only be doing the main, right? I'm the best, I'm Western, I only do the best, right? You know, so then we throw it out. And so renunciation doesn't matter. Is that the sense? So the point is it's important, but it has its place. Because of its support of devotion, it has importance. On its own, it doesn't have any importance, either for karma, it means it'll only generate karma or gyan.
So when looking at someone like Srila Gaurakshara and Babaji, renunciation is a self-product.
Yes, it's just something he does. He's so busy chanting that what is, and you know, and he doesn't, you know, no food has come along, no one's brought anything, and you know, he'd rather chant than go out begging. Then when he's chanting and it gets, the hunger gets too much, he just reaches down, picks up some dirt from the side of the you know, where he's sitting, throws that in his mouth, and then stomach goes quiet, you know, and he keeps on chanting. I wouldn't recommend trying it.
Don't try this at home.
Yeah, don't try this at home. You know, it's also, you know, only the professionals are, you know, like that. Because if you eat dirt raw, uncooked, you can go blind. Yeah, so that's why it's said that at the end of his life he was going blind. Because he would do that a lot. Eat dirt. That's why there is a preparation. We see that when it was in Raghava's bag, Raghava's jolly, that was sent to Lord Chaitanya every year. One of them is you take the fine Ganga mud. You sometimes see it when you're at the side of the river and you get these chunks of just super fine, fine mud. Like that. If you taste it, it's very sweet. So they take that, you know, dissolve it in water, then sift it through cloth and that to get out any sand in that. Then you cook that with sugar. Like that. And ghee, I think. And make it into little balls like that. So it's one kind of sweet. Yeah, like that.
When we eat the people eat the dirt in Vrindavan, they offer some little biscuits.
Yeah, you don't have to worry that that's it. You'll eat it. Then. But if you sat there every day, you ate one of those, then you might have problems. You know what I'm saying? That's why everything needs a balance. Of course, if you're liberated, who cares? You know, that's why I'm saying you don't take it the other way. I don't eat that, you go blind. No, it's just like regular eating of dirt. Then you get like that. You know, understand? That's why what you see is that babies eat dirt and at some point they stop. You know, otherwise it's not going to work.
I was looking at that blind, but the sweetness.
Oh, yeah. You've noticed that. It has that sweetness. Yeah. Because that's just the straight clay. Clay is sweet by nature. Because clay is like kapha, and that's sweet. Right? So in Ayurveda, it's sweet. So if you took that clay and cooked that with sugar and ghee, then you'd get that, what we're talking about.
I thought you felt like eating more.
Yeah. Because it's sweet. Well, that's why Krishna's eating it. So Raghava Pandit would make that for Lord Chaitanya. So it's one of the kind of sweets. Yeah. But it has to be pure clay. There can't be any other kind of dirt in it. Otherwise, the other kinds of dirt are not sweet. Yeah, they'll have different clay, different tastes like that. But pure clay is actually sweet. Okay, so because of the superficial differences between the different processes of retraction, right, because they'll be applied in a different area, so we think it's different, but it's the same thing. Retraction is simply to pull oneself out of the material energy, the attraction of the material energy, retract from that so that we can become attracted to Krishna, right? To avoid such controversies, the retraction should be properly followed in association with theistic knowledge and appropriate renunciation. Right? So when you have proper knowledge and proper renunciation, appropriate. So appropriate means according to your situation. Right? Does that make sense? You know, so if for you it's natural to function on a more renounced platform, you do that. But if not, you function. The point is that you're in a situation where you're connecting it to Krishna. That's what you're trying to do. Like that. So the renunciation's not the main... No, but he should be more renounced. Because why? Why should the person be more renounced?
Because his material attachments is getting in the way of his service.
No, because he enjoys it, he should be.
Yes, that's the real reason. Because he's being very renounced, and he would actually like to do what the other guy's doing. But if he can do it and still be devotional, then why can't he? No, why can't he do it? So the other one shouldn't do it because he's decided this is devotional service. So the other person is not actually devoted because he's not renounced like.
So it's kind of like going back to the question of all the other devotees having the problem.
Yes, yes, yes.
Then I'm right.
You're on board. Down. You know, you can.
I'm on the same page.
Yeah, you can add this onto a finer detail of you.
I'll just note it here.
Yes, yes. So when you're explaining to others how to follow the path, you have more knowledge.
So.
Yeah. So the thing is it's that because. The person is getting in the way of their advancement, then it's a problem. But if it's not getting in the way of their advancement, you know what I'm saying? It's like somebody has a little money, right? So let's say he has 10 gold coins, okay? So now if he gives up 2 gold coins, you know, it would seem like something. But now someone else has 100 gold coins. So for him, the same amount would be giving up 20, right? So the point is 20 is appropriate for the one, 2 is appropriate for the other. They say, oh, he gave up 20, you only gave up 2. But 20 is double of what he has. You know what I'm saying? So appropriate means it's balanced with whatever is the actual situation. Does that make sense? So one has to see that. One doesn't compare. Well, I'm doing this and everybody else who doesn't do this is nonsense. No, it may work for you. That may be the easy part. What about the other parts that they're doing more and you're doing less? Right? Because you don't relate to it, therefore... Yeah, yes.
So that would mean, especially that which you're not able to engage, that is where it's... Because that's the Grihastha, he engages his facility.
Yeah, but still, the engagement is the retraction. You know, that's the point being made, is that the sense control, it doesn't mean the senses aren't engaged, but the sense control, meaning you're just taking prasad, or it's a kata so you don't eat grains. So that control, that renunciation, is in line with devotion, but it's not that it's on its own separate. Right? So that's the thing, is they go together, but it doesn't mean sacrifice. You know, doesn't mean that you're not having facilities. The brahmachari sacrifices, you know, how you say, he's just engaging in direct activities, right? He could be sleeping or, you know, doing something else, but he doesn't. But for the grihastha, then it's engaging facilities that the brahmachari doesn't have. You know what I'm saying? So we might look at, oh, the grihastha is not renounced. But the point is it's just the same. Whatever is your facility that you're engaging. Right? The brahmachari has nothing, so all he has is some time, so then he engages that. Right? So the grihastha has that and others. So then if he doesn't put in what we're putting, he's not very renounced. But the point is if you had the facility the grihastha had, would you be doing what the grihastha is doing? Right? You know, he has money, he's giving money. Would you be doing that? You know what I'm saying? That's the point. So it's... The renunciation means its connection to the Lord. So it's either in the positive that you have it, you're connecting to the Lord, or you'll get more from not involving with it. So it doesn't matter. But the point is that it's only part of the process. If it's seen separately, then there'll always be so many differences of opinion. You know, which Bhaktivinoda says is unnecessary. Different processes of retraction, there are sectarian controversies which are quite unnecessary. right? So sectarian here means it's non-devotional. So there'd be so many non-devotional arguments over how renounced someone should be. But unless it's seen, you know, all your sannyasis and brahmins, they're all into renunciation and this and that. That's just not, you've ruined the society with it. But where's Krishna in all this? It's not even a consider of more Krishna conscious, less Krishna. It's just a matter of there's a problem with renunciation. You know, oh, grihasthas are also attached, this, that, you know, so then they can't get. It's the same thing. It's sectarian controversies. You know, because we'll take, sectarian means outside. Oh, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is meaning that also. But he's also meaning that with us. Back to this class. I think he has all the new kids.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Here someone may protest. The dindima drama, the Vedic conclusion proclaims, knowledge brings liberation. As for you, why do you emphasize the word spiritual knowledge? Why must this knowledge be spiritual in its character? Right? Because you're saying is that knowledge brings liberation. But why do you always say spiritual knowledge? Why not any knowledge? Because it just says knowledge. Right?
What's the dindima?
Dindima. There's those little X-shaped drums. Like Lord Shiva. Yeah, because they're very, make a lot of noise. They're all together. Otherwise, it's a bit like that. You know, that one goes, aww. It starts off, you know, the other side. It gets it together. No, it's just that it's just that the class was because for 3 weeks all the new kids were in their own section, but then after the 3 weeks they came into the main section, so the classes are much bigger. So before it was like you start a class like that, you wouldn't hear anything. That's the little dinky guys. Like, they're squeaky, but now so you have all these. Okay, Sutra 30. To refute this objection, the author speaks the following words. Sutra 37. Jnanan muktihi jnanad bhandascha. Divine knowledge brings liberation, and mundane knowledge brings bondage. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. The first kind of knowledge here is spiritual knowledge, or knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The word muktihi means liberation from material bondage. The second kind of knowledge here is material knowledge, or also the dry theories of the impersonalists. The word bandha here means bondage in the cycle of repeated births and deaths. Right? So when it says knowledge brings liberation, then one wonders what knowledge it means. You know, because here that's his point. So why does it have to be spiritual? But the point is, we've already defined liberation can only happen in connection with devotional service. Others may temporarily get out of material entanglement and then be re-entangled. So that you can't call liberation. You know, it's like the, what do you call it? The Habu-Dubu. Habu-Dubu. Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions it. The dunking stool. You take a chair, right? And you put it on and tie someone in the chair, and the chair is tied on a long pole, right? And the pole is put on a balance, and then, you know, and then you hold one end and drop it into the water, right? So when the person's underwater, he can't get away because he's tied in the chair. So when he's just about to drown, then you pull them out of the water, right? And then they take a big breath, you know? And then just as they finish taking the big breath, before they can take another one, you put them back down in the water again. So that's called Pabodubo. It's in one of the songs. It's one of the songs. You probably regularly sing it. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, Habudubo, something nigh, something like that.
So what was the point was to get
there? So the point is that, huh?
No, but I mean...
What's the point? The point is it's a kind of punishment.
Yeah.
You know.
But is it like to like the Vedic form of torture to get somebody to talk or to...
No, that's spent.
That's?
Spent. But they don't actually want them to talk. They just want to have some fun before they drown them.
It's like waterboarding. That's
the same principle.
American,
same. But let's not get distracted by that. No, but then, how much balance is it? What kind of chair?
Can you demonstrate?
So... the point is that if in liberation you come out for a minute, get a breath, and then are put back into the material energy, you can't call that actual liberation. Liberation means you're freed from the problem of being materially bound. So only devotional service can do that. So that would mean not any knowledge will bring that kind of liberation. It can only be spiritual knowledge. Does that make sense? That's why he says the bondage and the cycle of repeated births and deaths, right? And he says mukti means liberation from material bondage, right? So now he's saying material bondage, the repeated cycle of birth and death, right? We find the same concept in Sri Upanishad, Mantra 10, where it is stated. The wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. Shrushi Upanishad further discriminates between two levels of bondage, the ordinary ignorance and the false knowledge. The distinction is shown in Mantra 9. Those who engage in the culture of nescient activity shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. Right? In the following words, the Supreme Personality of Godhead affirms that material knowledge binds one to the material world. He says, Bhagavad Gita 14.6, those situated in that mode, goodness, develop knowledge, but they become conditioned by the concept of happiness. Right? So it's good, but they're still conditioned. Also, the other thing is you have the element of that the liberationists might complain that, no, we're giving spiritual knowledge, but according to their own definition, words and language is false.
Yeah.
Right? That you're thinking you're an individual... You know, that there's discussion, that there's relationship, there's a teacher and a student, it's all false. So actually they're engaging themselves in material knowledge. So therefore they will be bound by that. Right? By their own definition. You know? Yes.
Maharaj, in that sutra 37, the first divine knowledge would it be para and apara vidya, and the other one, the mundane, would it be avidya?
Not necessarily. That means, yeah, it would be avidya. It means if you don't know how to use it, apara vidya. But apara vidya, unless it's connected. Apara means it's connected. Because the same thing not connected is called avidya. Right? Well, let's say we take the Veda. You know, let's say kalpa. You're using the mantras of the Veda for a ritual, right? So now, if you're using the mantras for the ritual, if you see it in connection to the Lord, then it's called apara vidya. If you don't see it in connection to the Lord, it's avidya. Even though it's recommended by the shastras, it'll elevate you to the heavenly planets, right? That'll be avidya. So that's the difference, is how do you perceive what is that knowledge that can be connected, you know, but whether, you know, and its position when it is connected or not, right? So the Upanishads basically will take that apara vidya is avidya, because the person who's engaging in the apara vidya, how much are they actually seeing it in connection with transcendence? You know what I'm saying? So that's why basically Upanishads are meant for the renunciates. right? Because then there is minimal involvement with all the Vedic branches of knowledge except for the transcendence, right? So Gita, so it's not as accessible, but Gita makes this knowledge accessible to everyone, because the actual sannyas means giving up the desire for the results before you've performed the action. So that everybody can do. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that is not necessarily appreciated or understood by those who, you know, specifically just study the Upanishads. Okay. The conclusion of the atheist and blasphemers is given in the words of the Vidvan Moda Tarangini. What is action? Who is the seer of things? When and by whom are karmic reactions obtained? How does one attain another birth in this world? If someone asks these questions, then I reply, these questions have no answers. There is no way anyone can find answers to these questions. The truth is that life is like a flowing river that brings sometimes pleasure and sometimes pain. The material body is temporary. It will die. The truth is that the entire world is unreal. It does not really exist. It is all an illusion. This type of pseudo-knowledge, this is the conclusion of the atheists and blasphemers. Vidvan Moda Tarangini. Whose book is that? Oh, he doesn't mention who it is, but it must be a popular book or something, a known book. Okay. This type of pseudo-knowledge results in more bondage of the jivas. It is known as empiric knowledge. Even the animals belong to this category because they too are not aware of the results of their activities and about their past and future. This type of atheistic people spend their time following the urges of their senses and at the end of life attain downfall. So you get here is that you have the element, they know it's all temporary, it's all going to be this and that. But you can't really tell what's going to happen, you don't know, so therefore you just do whatever you want. You know what I'm saying? So you have the person who, he does whatever he wants just because he feels like, and he never even thinks about whether he should do something or not. You know, then there's a person who may think about it and think, you know, there may be some higher purposes, but they're unable to regulate themselves, right? Right? Or then there's the person who has committed himself that, no, I like doing this and I'm going to do this and I couldn't care less if anybody else likes this or not, right? But there is the class of person who needs kind of a philosophical reason why they don't have to follow anything. And so they come up with this kind of philosophy.
So they basically study for 20, 30 years to come back to the same conclusion as the Buddha.
Yeah, or in this case, the animals. Right? Because the animals, they don't know what action, they don't know who's the seer, they don't know about karmic reactions, they don't know about birth. So if one doesn't know this, then that makes one an animal. Right, so so this is the empiric knowledge. On the other hand, those who do not believe in the existence of the individual soul and want to become merged with Brahman are dry Gnostics. But real liberation is attained only by those souls who became liberated by experiencing the bliss of love of God. Those who have attained nirvana cannot be called liberated because their state is only advancement in the sattva-gun, and they will not be able to taste the bliss of love towards the absolute, which is beyond the triple qualities of phenomena. So they won't get past the mode of goodness. Right? So that means they'll be bound still to this world. In the Chaitanya Chandradoya Nataka 777, Srila Ramananda Roy explains, they who cannot taste sweetness will drink the bitter neem juice of impersonal liberation. We, however, who know what is sweet, drink the dark, sweet nectar the amorous gopis drank through the corners of their eyes. In response to Lord Chaitanya's questions, Sri Ramananda Roy explained, Chaitanya Chandradoya Nataka 761, They who love Krishna's lotus feet and do not love anything else, who delight in bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotional service, and are not attracted to astanga yoga or any other kind of yoga, and who place their love in the transcendental form of Lord Krishna and not in their own external material body, are actually liberated and free from the material world. Non-devotees who claim to be liberated are not so. So very straightforward. You had something? In the next sutra, the author explains the meaning of the word yukta, appropriate, in the phrase yukta vairagya, appropriate renunciation. So then when he said before that word appropriate, he meant yukta vairagya. So yukta vairagya is what is meant, so when we're talking about retraction, this is what we mean. Is you're pulling yourself out of the material energy by engaging yourself in the Lord's service. So it's not a separate thing. So the appropriate. So yukta vairagya means it's appropriate. So instead it says, oh, it's yukta vairagya. But the point is, the yukta means appropriate. So is it appropriate? If it is, great, it's yukta vairagya. Right? But if it's not appropriate, means it's not connected to Krishna, it's not correct for the situation or the person involved in the situation, then it's not yukta vairagya. Sutra 38. Vairagyan mukti vairagyad bhandascha. Proper renunciation brings liberation, whereas dry renunciation brings additional bondage. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. In this sutra, the author explains the meaning of the word yukta, appropriate in the phrase yukta vairagya, appropriate renunciation. Renunciation is of two kinds. One, yukta vairagya, appropriate renunciation, and two, falgu vairagya, false renunciation. Proper renunciation is formed when, without being attached to the results of one's work, and acting purely and in a saintly manner, one offers the results of his work to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This kind of renunciation brings liberation from the bondage of repeated birth and death. Yeah. This is the Ishavasya concept. In Sri Ishupanishad mantras 1-2, it is stated, everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and which one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way, for that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man. Right? So here is Upanishad is saying there is no alternative. It's not like you can do something else. It may be, oh, that's one opinion or like that. No, this is... Sri Upanishad outlines the Ishavasya principle for a broad range of transcendentalists. In Bhagavad Gita, this principle is developed and explained from social and metaphysical point of view. Bhagavad Gita states that the highest application of Ishavasya is pure devotional service to the Lord. The nectar of devotion reveals how the Ishavasya is understood and applied specifically by the devotees of the Lord. And the nectar of instruction summarizes the process of refinement and presents the ultimate understanding of the same principle. Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport to Mantra 2. It's interesting how he connects all the four books, you know, together. When altruistic activities are executed in the spirit of Sri Ishupanishad, they become a form of karma yoga. Such activities are recommended in the Bhagavad Gita 18:5-9. For they guarantee their executor protection from the danger of sliding down into the evolutionary process of birth and death. Even though such God-centered activities may be half-finished, they are still good for the executor, because they will guarantee him a human form in his next birth. In this way, one can have another chance to improve his position on the path of liberation. How one can execute God-centered activities is elaborately explained in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by Srila Rupa Goswami. We have rendered this book into English as The Nectar of Devotion. We recommend this valuable book to all who are interested in performing their activities in the spirit of Sri Ishopanishad. This second paragraph in here, the quote, where is that from?
Okay.
Yeah, because it was small, so it's not big, and so because there should be some way to note when you're speaking. But you can tell. I mean, the quotations. That's what. But sometimes that's not caught. But that's. I mean, that's pretty standard.
What was that paragraph?
No. Oh, I see. It's also in it's not in the italics. It means this whole small section is from Ishopanishad, but the second paragraph is not in quotes. Is then the sub author's comments. The assistant author. Yes. In Bhagavad Gita 6.1, the Supreme Personality of Godhead explains, one who is unattached to the fruits of his work, and who works as he is obliged, is in the renounced order of life, and he is the true mystic. Right. So here, just that you're unattached to the work and you're doing it because you're supposed to do it. Then one is in the renounced order. That's sannyas, right? So that will work. Now, that being connected to Krishna, right? Because that's what his point before has been, right? Then that brings the devotion. But otherwise, then he is the... So he is doing... He's unattached. He's working as obliged. So therefore... And, you know, it's being offered to Krishna. So that's the true mystic. Like that. So that's why we should see all these things, they don't stand separately. Because Krishna's always said everything should be done for him. So then when he's talking about a specific detail of an activity, we should not think that the activity stands on its own. No, it's in the context that it's already connected to the Lord. Right? You know, like in the recipe book. You know, it's understood that you're, in the beginning, they're talking about how it's offered to Krishna and everything like this. So it's not everywhere in the recipe. It keeps saying about, you know, are you remembering the Lord? You know, looks good, doesn't it? But it's not for you. You know, like that. You know. Huh?
Someone should do that.
Oh, yeah. Put in the cook room, remind. Okay. But you might get so absorbed and go into ecstasy and then the thing will burn or something. You know.
Cooking for Krishna for idiots. Yeah. I mean, in this, Bhaktivinoda makes the point, enacting purely and in a saintly manner, one offers a result of his work to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I mean, that's a point we sometimes...
acting purely in a saintly manner.
Especially if you look at, you know, his communicating.
No, but what do you call saintly? You need the little halo? Or
no.
You have to be canonized first and then you'll be saintly? You know what I'm saying? It's because it's already been pointed out. Purely means according to what is the duties. Like that. You know, saintly means that it's being done
character.
Yeah, like that. So these elements are there. It means you have to see is what is the situation, how what that means, how it's being applied. Because like Arjuna is doing this, but on the battlefield, so he's fighting. So one would say, well, if he was saintly, he wouldn't be fighting. But that's our definition of saintly. You know, they're saintly as the actual quality. You know, and then they'll be saintly as how will can take it and connect it with a noun. You know, or with a situation. So we have to be careful is that our connection is always that it goes back to its connection to Krishna. Because saintly is, you know, it's the using qualities that it's going to be done for Krishna according to Shastra, Guru Sadhu and Shastra. Because otherwise, the one could be not attached to the result, you know, acting purely, but you know, offering the result, but it's not according to Shastra, you know, or something. Does that make sense?
Dikarma yoga.
Yeah, Dikarma yoga. So.
Of giving the results.
Yeah, but I'm saying it works for someone functioning on the platform of Vikarma. That's where you start from. But it doesn't. It's not traditionally. It's not used as a standard because basically not a whole lot of people can function on that. Right? What is it called? Namala Nila. Not all of Anguru. Yeah, all I can think of is Nila. He's got another one. Nila, then, he was one of the 12 Alwars. So he had 3 disciples. One who could hide in his own shadow, one that could walk in water, and one could open any lock. Right? So in the day they'd be doing all their standard service and preaching and deity worship and that. And at night they'd use their expertise for
traveling sankirtan park.
Yes. Yes.
Collectively.
Yes. And so as long as he was present, but when he was going to leave, he got rid of them first. Because other than him, no one would be able to engage them. You understand? So it's not a path, you know, that one would take up with on one's own enthusiasm, own inspiration. No? False renunciation, on the other hand, is dry, makes the heart hard, makes one proud, is petty, is likened to the renunciation practiced by monkeys living in the forest, and brings the sufferings of repeated birth and death in the material world as its true result. In the Shruti Shastra it is said, not by mere renunciation does one obtain liberation. Right? Because before they were quoting from Shruti, now again he's giving the other. In Bhagavad Gita 18.8, the Supreme Personality of Godhead explains, anyone who gives up prescribed duties as troublesome or out of fear is said to be in the mode of passion. Such action never leads to the elevation of renunciation. Means, yeah, because mode of passion is you want a particular result. So if it's going to be too much trouble, then it's like not worth the result, not worth the endeavor. Right? So if one sees that the amount of effort to put into the material world, it's not worth it, so one will put all one's energy into the spiritual, then that's proper. Right? But to see that there's trouble in material engagement, therefore give up that engagement but not take up the devotional, not replace it with that, then that's the mode of passion. Or fear, you know, that one's going to lose something. In Bhagavad Gita 3.6, the Supreme Personality of Godhead again explains, one who restrains the senses and organs of action, but whose mind dwells on sense objects, certainly deludes himself and is called a pretender. So, yeah, so one is restraining the senses and not engaging anything, but one is meditating upon whatever it is that one's restraining senses from. That's also not proper. Right? So these things are being said because then one should make those adjustments. Right? That's the point. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.2.256, Srila Rupa Goswami explains, when one is not attached to anything, but at the same time accepts anything in relation to Krishna, One is rightly situated above possessiveness. On the other hand, one who rejects everything without knowledge of its relation to the Lord is not as complete in his renunciation. Right? You don't deal with anything, so it'll keep one detached, but he's not actually that well situated. But someone who is not attached to anything but will accept anything in Krishna's service, because it's like, okay, I'm not attached to that, I want to accept that for use in Krishna's service. You know, it's just like the person who's fasting on Ekadasi, you know, will not help serving Prasad. You know, because they're so renounced, why should they be involved in that? You know, all the gross sense gratifiers who are eating, you know, Ekadasi breakfast, they should be doing the serving. But the point is that no, it's service to the Vaishnavas.
Well, I think Prabhupada was giving also the example of those sannyasis who don't want to touch money.
Yes, yeah, that was that. Yeah.
Prabhupada says, hey.
Yeah, there was one famous sannyasi. When they come with money, he puts his hands behind his back. Oh, so renounced. No, you have to give it to the servant. Yeah. In Bhagavad Gita 18:7-8, the Supreme Personality of Godhead explains, prescribed duties should never be renounced. If, by illusion, one gives up his prescribed duties, such renunciation is said to be in the mode of ignorance. Okay, so if one gives it up out of trouble or fear, that's passion. If one gives it up out of illusion, that's ignorance. Anyone who gives up prescribed duties is troublesome or out of fear, it is said to be in the mode of passion. Such action never leads to the elevation of renunciation. Right? You're giving up the duties, but it's not that you'll become more renounced. Right? You stay just as attached. You're just not involved with it. In Bhagavad Gita 18:9 and 18:11, the Supreme Personality of Godhead again explains, but he who performs his prescribed duties only because it ought to be done and renounces all attachment to the fruit, his renunciation is of the nature of goodness or Arjuna. Right? That's what Rupa Goswami was talking about. It is indeed impossible for an embodied being to give up all activities. Therefore, it is said that he who renounces the fruits of action is the one who is truly renounced. Right? Because the impersonalists will make it sound as that the one who's renounced is the one who's given up work. But actually, the living entity can't give up work. Because otherwise, if they could give up everything, why are they still talking? Why haven't they crawled into a hole somewhere and disappeared? Right? But they're still talking. They're still going around. They're all still active. Why? Because in their philosophy, it's all nonsense. But they have to do it because the soul, by nature, is active. You can't give it up. So then the point is not giving up action. The point is giving up the results of action. That's the point. Your existence is there. Activities are going to be there. So now it's a matter of results. So, who's the result for? That's then the actual renunciation. Bhagavad Gita 4:20-21, the Supreme Personality of Godhead again explains, abandoning all attachment to the results of his activities, ever satisfied and independent, he performs no fruit of action, although engaged in all kinds of undertakings. Right? This is where it's confusing. He's doing everything, but he has nothing to gain. So he's actually independent. You know? That makes sense. Such a man of understanding acts with mind and intelligence perfectly controlled, gives up all sense of proprietorship over his possessions, and acts only for the bare necessities of life. Thus working, he is not affected by sinful reactions. Right?
One of his action.
Yes. But yes. And what we also see here is that it's talking about of understanding acts of mind and intelligence perfectly controlled. Right? So he's showing the various elements of their connection. Right? How do I say not connection? Their retraction. Right? So here is that giving up the sense of proprietorship, right? Because the mind is, you know, the mind element. So giving up, that is then retraction of the mind, because the mind says it's mine, right? And actually for the bare necessities of life. So whatever duties give what, so you only need so much, so therefore you only get so much, that's intelligence. Right? Well, here he just mentioned mind and intelligence. Because bare necessities, that means he's only bringing that out, that you only engage the senses in bare necessities. But here he's acting only four. So that's another step. How does he engage those bare necessities? So here he's only getting bare necessities. Does that make sense? The senses are what you're going to do with those bare necessities. You know what I'm saying? Because still, even though you have bare necessities, you know, it could be pretty good, you know. The guy's been, you know, stuck out in the, you know, the desert for, you know, 3 days and hasn't eaten, so he only gets something very simple, you know, like a piece of dry bread or something like that. But for him, that's like, you know, ecstasy, you know. Yeah. So then it's a matter of the senses. How are they engaged? Right, and also, like you said before, he's acting, so it's time, but he's not doing it for himself, so there's no modes, so there's no karma. Right, so time is what connects you to the material energy, so you can't not function without that. So, but there's no sinful reaction because there's no karma. Bhagavad Gita 6:17 and 18, the Supreme Personality of Godhead again explains. He who is temperate in his habits of eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all material pains by practicing the yoga system. When the yogi, by practice of yoga, disciplines his mental activities and becomes situated in transcendental, devoid of all material desires, he is said to have obtained yoga. So the mental activities will be accepting and rejecting. So when you reject the material and accept the spiritual, but that means engagement. It means who's the result for? Remember, the mind deals with is the prayojana, right? So the result. So when the results for Krishna, that's accepting the spiritual, and it's not for me. So that's rejecting the material. So it's very, very simple. That's all it is, right? It's that simple. You just have to get your mind to just reject any results that it's not for Krishna. You just accept all those who are. That's simple. Okay, yeah, you're done. Okay.
What's the test?
Neophyte generally means that the element of mix is there. So, you know, sometimes it's strong, sometimes it's weak, sometimes all these different elements. So, as we were discussing before, is that you may be enthusiastic about it, so you don't notice them. There's no focus on them. So it's good, but it's not that one's not doing all one's crazy stuff. You know, it's just like, how you say, you know, the person just bumped into the devotees on Harinam, followed them back to the temple, you know, this and that. It was great talk, this and that, you know, in the afternoon. And then, you know, he goes and meets his friends at that little cafe that he always goes to and orders his, you know, how you say, his cappuccino. And while sitting there, very enthusiastic, talking about the devotees. So he hasn't renounced it, but it's not important. So it doesn't have the effect, because he's so absorbed in that. But with time, then it will get, it won't be so new. So then there's that, and then there's his lifestyle, then there's the, you know, Krishna consciousness lifestyle. Then it's a matter, well, you know, you can't engage your lifestyle like this, or, you know, I should become more detached. So he has to find the balance like that. So neophyte generally means that this is all what's going on.
Okay. In Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.8-10, Srila Sutta Goswami explains, the occupational activities a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. Right? So if they don't, so we were saying before, is the renunciation only has value in its assisting in attraction to Krishna. So if he's performing his prescribed duties, right, according to his position very nicely, but it doesn't help evoke attraction to the Lord, means he's not, they're not being engaged to retract himself out of material engagement, then basically it's useless. You know, he's not saying that he's doing occupational duties is useless. He's saying if it doesn't evoke Krishna consciousness, then it's useless. Right? All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation, which ultimate means devotional service. Otherwise, they just say liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to the sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. I saw in one translation a devotee was making for kids. He said, one should not always use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. They changed it. Here it says never. Like that. You know, that's a bit strong. Why, that was it? Oh, okay, not that.
The point.
What do you mean, never? Not even. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll come back when you're speaking on something more nice. Okay, then this is... 8 through 10. Life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's work. Right? That doesn't mean that one should desire only a healthy life, that means one turns into a total, you know, health fanatic. Yeah, it just means that of anything that you might ask, that's the only thing, because if you're healthy, you can do service. So that's the only point. But just to be healthy, you know, that it in its own has its own end, its own benefit, then like renunciation, one's missed the point. Right? Because sometimes if you notice, really lazy people sometimes are very healthy. You know, because they never overdo it, you know, they don't work too hard, you know, like that, just the right amount, you know, like that. Maybe, you know, on a special occasion we'll carry the dishes to the kitchen, but not every day. You wouldn't want to, and definitely you wouldn't want to wash them, right? You know, so I mean that would be fanatic. So. Here someone may ask, what will happen if someone practices devotional cultivation but fails in the practice of renunciation? The following sutra satisfies this doubt. Right? So in other words, this tendency to whichever point he talks on, you bring up a doubt on the opposite, has been going on for a long time. Remember, this is written back in the mid-1800s. So it's, you know, like 150 years ago. But when you look at when he's talking specifically about the mentality of the people at the time, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta was born a little later in this time. His one complaint is that the middle class, this up-and-coming middle class, right? So they always seem to be up-and-coming. They never quite make it. They're always just up-and-coming. And so they're just worried about material education and that by that, then you'll be successful in life. Right, they're not interested in following the Vedic conclusions. Sounds familiar? Yeah. Right, so when he made this statement, you know, this was, you know, 100 years ago. You know, and that was from experience of watching all those who would be around, you know, his father. You know, which takes it back some more time.
And in 100 years, people would still be reading it.
Yes, that's what's so nice about the achar. When Prabhupada says that, you know, these, you know, the teachings are, you know, the Veda is eternal. It means this, you know, that, you know, his books will be valuable for the next 10,000 years. So then one can understand as those points that people are disturbed that no, the modern society won't accept this. One can understand the modern society is temporary. Because if it's going to be good for 10,000 years, it means that's going to go away at some point. Right. Sutra 39. Pratyahara sampate para bhakya siddhav api narah patanam. In the observation of devotional cultivation, if the renunciation is not properly followed, the ultimate bhakti is not attained, although the aspirant is safeguarded from downfall. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura's commentary. Unless the body, mind, and senses are controlled by the help of theistic knowledge and proper renunciation, the observation of devotional cultivation cannot provide any upliftment. Now he started using theistic knowledge. Before now he's using, once he introduced it, then now it's theistic knowledge. Right? Because in other words, knowledge has come from devotional service. So the knowledge and renunciation of the only gain of such practice is that it will guard the aspirant from downfall. Right? You won't advance, but you won't fall down. So you just kind of stay there in that pleasant, you know,
semi-pleasant.
Yeah, middle. In Bhagavad Gita 6.40, the Supreme Personality of Godhead explains, O Sanaprita, a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities, does not meet with destruction either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. So that will remain. So this is also the thing, is that he won't fall down, right? So that will remain. But at the same time, as his only real good is, you know, just because he don't fall down doesn't mean it's great. Yes.
That's why we see people in our temples. They're coming for years. They keep coming every Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
But they never seem to be making any.
Yeah, because it just they're not the renunciation means. The activities of their personal life aren't being connected well to Krishna. Because the point is it's not that they're family persons and only can come once a week. That's not what's getting in the way. You know, generally we'll say, well, that's what gets in the way. But it's a lack of actually engagement that comes by association. You know, so but due to lack of association, they're not able to see how to connect what they're doing to the Lord. You had something beside it.
How we define downfall in this?
How we define downfall?
Yeah.
How down are you looking at? Where is your doubt?
Does it refer just to remain? Does the safeguard mean that he will be in a human life or will maintain his position in terms of his practice? One-sided practice.
I would say both would be there. But if his one-sided practice becomes even more lopsided, then, you know, it definitely will save him from going down into the animal species. Right? Because that in the purport, that's what Prabhupada explains. But you'll also have the example of where someone just comes to a particular level of advancement and just kind of stays like that for a very, very long time. It just means that, you know, he's performing his devotional activities, you know, his regular chanting or whatever, but he's not seeing that these indirect activities are being properly connected to the Lord. So that renunciation, giving up the result. He's performing his duties while giving up the result. So he's performing his duties but not seeing the result in connection to the Lord. So it gets in the way of further advancement. But he is chanting and everything. You know, but just, you know, how far will that take you if you're also very absorbed? Because the actual definition in the advancement is how much you're connecting yourself to Krishna. Now, simultaneously, that means that you're detaching yourself from the material energy. Otherwise, you're attached to material energy, then to that degree you won't be able to remember Krishna. You know what I'm saying? But their sadhana is going on, they do the basics, but it doesn't go any farther. That's because they're not connecting or engaging their conditional activities to the Lord. It means the results aren't for Krishna, or they're not seeing them in connection to Krishna in some way. Does that make sense? You know, it's like the example of the Prabhupada gives of the wedding party. Right? The wedding party, after the wedding, they come down, you know, because they're from another village, so they come down to get in the boat and all that, and everyone goes to sleep, and the oarmen are all rowing all night and all that. And when the sun comes up in the morning, they're still at the same, you know, dock. And then they're trying to figure out what happened. And he says, we went to sleep, you guys went to sleep also. No, we were rowing all night. And then they're trying to figure out then what could have happened. Then when they look around, then they figure out they didn't pull out the anchor. Right? So that's the point, is that you don't go backwards. You know, it wasn't that now they found themselves back at the house where the wedding happened, you know, and in the boat. You know, that's really embarrassing. Right? Can you imagine that? You wake up in the morning and you're in the boat, in their living room like that, you know? Not only that, you knocked over the grandmother's vase, you know, all that stuff. You know, like that. I mean, of course, they shouldn't have been keeping the ashes in the living room anyway, but, you know, it's like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it won't go forward, yes.
But when you speak about devotees that have made a certain amount of advancement and they may even become distracted, they seem like a downfall, but once they start the process again, they're at the same level.
Yes. Yeah. Because it's not lost. See, all these things means you have two angles to look at it. One is where you're encouraging, so whatever situation you're in, you're encouraged to try to move forward. And the other is to look at it analytically so that one can see what are weaknesses in one's own practice so that one can try to develop it and move forward. Right? So as far as the point, they're not going to fall down below that point. So even if they become distracted, and we would say it's a fall down, but as soon as they come in contact with the process again, they continue from where they left off. So their devotional service didn't go backwards. Their situation might not be ideal, but the loss of the devotional service is not there. And they won't have the problem of falling into the animal species, you know, which even a pious person has that fear. Like King Riga, you know, he performed so many sacrifices, said like the grains of sand on the beach. But still, he ended up as an animal. So it's not a very fail-safe method, right? Only devotional service. So does that make sense? So either. Okay, just in case you were wondering.
Also, the example is the part of the offense.
Yeah, so one doesn't advance. But it doesn't mean one falls back. Right? It just means you won't move forward. Is that okay?
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki. Jayatai Gaura Premanandi.